It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. It's not easy to plan a wedding under any circumstance. So many ideas and traditions and judgments to consider and weigh, what friends and family might think about how we do this or that. But for same-sex or other non-binary couples, weddings can be even more complex and challenging to navigate. In part, that's because many parts of the wedding industry developed over the years to serve a bride and a groom and didn't quickly catch up after same-sex marriage became legal around the country. Our next guest examined what happens to people in that position where they're trying to wade through a marketplace that wasn't set up to serve them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think about how the wedding industry does or doesn't serve same-sex couples? Are you part of a same-sex couple that's either planning a wedding or had one since same-sex marriage became legal around the country? What was your experience like working with different parts of the industry to put together whatever type or mix of ceremony, celebration, or event you had? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. Amber Epp is an associate professor of marketing in the Wisconsin School of Business. She's co-author of a study on this topic that was recently featured in the Journal of Consumer Research. Amber, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on, Rob. I'm excited to be here.
Well, you and your colleague did a lot of this research as same-sex marriage became legal, first in particular states around the country, then nationwide. Can you talk about the sort of interviews and shopalogs you had with the people you talked to?
Sure. So the lead author on this study, Sunaina Valicoletti Schultz, was working on her dissertation project right during the legalization of marriage between same-sex couples. And so we were really interested in how couples were navigating the change, as well as how the wedding industry was responding. So she spent about 2 years in the field between 2013 and 2015, interviewing 30 same-sex couples who are planning their weddings, as well as attending wedding expos and wedding industry conferences to see how the wedding industry itself was actually addressing the topic of legalization at the time.
What were some of the main things they encountered when they went to stores or went to the wedding expo?
I think one of the main things they encountered was just the being constantly confronted by the binary in the wedding script. So the wedding script itself is grounded in a bride-groom assumption, and that assumption carries out through most aspects of the wedding industry itself. And so going to wedding expos and bridal expos that you might see even here around Madison, same-sex couples were confronted with all sorts of, you know, forms that were asking for bride and groom or imagery that was just not very inclusive. A lack of awareness, I would say, at the time among vendors about how to do LGBT-friendly weddings or think more expansively about gender inclusivity than just kind of being locked into the assumptions of a bride and groom.
Now, you're coming at this as a marketing professor. I think a lot of sociologists have looked at these kind of, you know, changes and things like that. What, as a marketing professor, do you see in this about how a business, a big industry, actually the wedding industry, serves or maybe doesn't quite serve a part of their audience?
Yes, I'd say marketing is probably a strange home for this kind of study, because you're right, mostly sociologists look at this. And of course, we drew really heavily on the work of sociologists, as well as historians looking at the wedding industry, as well as marriage and the ideals that are kind of embedded in the wedding script itself that makes it a binary. I think from a business perspective, the reason that it makes sense in the business school is for companies to be a lot more aware of the assumptions that are built into their scripts. So we were looking at it from the perspective of consumers in the wedding market, the couples themselves, and what is their experience when they're in the marketplace shopping and they find an absence of diversity in the kinds of attire that are available, or they confront assumptions of the bride always being the one planning when really it's the groom that's doing all of the work in some of these scenarios, and what happens when the marketplace doesn't recognize that. And so I think for us, we were quite interested in the emotional experience of consumers as they were confronted with this binary over and over, and how that gave them a sense or a lack even of legitimacy, of not being in sync with the script, especially since the script was kind of written without them.
Talking to Amber Epp from the Wisconsin School of Business, co-author of a study on same-sex marriage and how the wedding industry, as same-sex marriage became legal, dealt with or didn't deal with that change, and the personal experiences of same-sex couples who encountered that. You could join in with your questions, maybe your own experiences, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Nick is with us in Fort Atkinson. Nick, hi.
Hi, Rob. Good to hear from you guys today on this subject. It's very important.
Yeah, what did you want to tell us about, Nick? You've got an experience?
Yeah, so I live just in Jefferson County, just to the east of Dane, and we got married about 4 years ago. We had to make an appointment. We just did a courthouse wedding, but I think it's kind of a shame that knowing ahead of time that we were a same-sex couple, the only forms they had on hand were for men and women, and so they literally looked at us and said, which of you wants to be the bride? And so far, it hasn't caused any kind of legal issues or anything like that, but we were hesitant, you know, and not given any warning other than the day of when we show up for our ceremony, that's how it was going to be. So it's kind of a shame that even at the state level, that's not just required to be on hand for same-sex couples.
And you couldn't, they wouldn't let you, like, cross out bride and write in groom two or something like that?
We weren't sure if that was going to make anything null or void, or what kind of legal implications that would be. So we just went ahead, and I guess I'm the bride.
All right, Nick, thank you. Sorry about that, but thank you so much for sharing that experience. Amber, this is something that the couples involved in your study ran into in some cases, and this is one of the strategies you found, saying up front, I can't remember which kind of wedding store it was, yeah, neither of us is the bride. Please don't call us the bride. Can you talk about that a little?
This was such a common experience in our data. So not just forms, but as you were saying, just the assumptions of who's going to be the bride. You know, all of the wedding script aspects, who's going to propose, whether both people should have an engagement ring, who's going to walk down the aisle, all of those things come with this assumption, this built-in assumption of a gender binary. And so even though, you know, every couple that's planning a wedding has to make choices about how to personalize the wedding, the couples in our study really had to confront that idea of taking on a role that was meant for a different gender and being constantly reminded that this is a binary. So I think that Nick's experience is unfortunate. It's exactly what we found in the study, that the industry itself was really slow to respond in terms of infrastructure and updating of forms, but also just in terms of questioning and re-examining their own assumptions about who might be participating in this space.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Amber, you and your co-author give, you know, different ways that same-sex couples dealt with some of these things they were encountering, and you just used one of the words, actually, confront. In some cases, same-sex couples went in and said, yeah, you're not set up for us. Here's what we're going to need from you. Can you talk about how that went?
So much of that, yes. So the couples in our study had lots of different strategies for navigating and both working with the wedding industry as well as kind of working against the wedding industry to try and get them to update the script to be more gender inclusive. So one of the strategies they used was just direct confrontation to say to the service provider or the courthouse, you know, you need to update your forms, you need to think more expansively about this. Other strategies involved more collaboration. So working with wedding photographers, for instance, to say, okay, here's what our vision is for the wedding, but we know that in positions in photographs, there's some semblance or signals of what gender roles, who's standing, who's sitting, where are people positioned? And we're really conscious about what that means for the way that we're positioned. So they did collaborate with marketplace service providers to say, how could we do this in a way that feels really authentic for us and also recognizes our own gender expression and gender roles. And then other examples are things like masking. So one of the things that we've found in prior literature really is that if you don't have to disclose something and it's easy for you to participate, so really feminine brides that were just shopping for a traditional wedding dress could kind of move through the space without having to constantly disclose that they were marrying another bride. And so we saw that in the study too. And for us, that was a really interesting point because many of the participants really talked about the emotional toll that took on them as they were planning the wedding, is really trying to navigate this space in a way that protected their emotions, but also allowed them to kind of authentically be themselves.
And another strategy, that experimenting one, where people are like, hey, we're doing something different. We're going to start inventing our own traditions here. Could you talk a little more about what that might have looked like?
That strategy was so surprising to me, actually. Of all the strategies that people used, experimenting was really just going out there to see what feels right. So let me just try on all the different things, especially for instance, brides who didn't really want to wear a dress. They didn't want to wear a traditional dress. Maybe they thought they would wear pants or a jumper. And then they just went shopping and tried on all the different things that felt right. But the surprising thing for me about that was that I anticipated that it would move the industry forward, that we would see lots more, a broader range of gender expression and those sorts of things. But instead, what we saw, at least among our participants, was a lot more of sticking really close to the script. So I'll give you a story from one of our participants, Jocelyn. So she is kind of the bride I described, where she planned on wearing pants. And then her mother-in-law, on a whim, just said, oh, let's go dress shopping. This will be really fun. And she said, okay, I guess I'll do that. I'm not really interested in buying a dress, but why not? It's part of the tradition. And then she put a dress on, and she immediately said she was kind of overwhelmed by this feeling of feeling like a bride. She said, ooh, I feel pretty. And then instantly she judged herself for that and said, oh, that's not how I'm supposed to, this isn't my authentic sort of gender expression. I wanted to wear pants, but this just feels right. So something about the tradition of the script really tugged at her, as well as kind of prior socialization, which we haven't really talked about much, but and that resulted in this experimenting often just leading people back to the comfort of the script. So instead of seeing experimenting as something that opened up possibilities and opened the door, instead we saw it actually just reinforcing sort of traditions in the script and people really sticking closely to that for the comfort and tradition that it offered.
We're talking to Amber Epp, Associate Professor of Marketing at the Wisconsin School of Business, talking about how same-sex couples plan wedding activities when the wedding industry is rooted in a bride and groom world. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions for our guest? Are we talking about you and your wedding story? Did you run into some of these decisions and maybe some friction with the wedding industry that wasn't built for you as a same-sex couple? For any kind of couple, did you push back against the traditions in the wedding world? Did you stick with it, or did you end up following the script? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Amber Epp, Associate Professor of Marketing in the Wisconsin School of Business. We're talking about a study she co-authored looking at same-sex couples and how they dealt with a wedding industry that wasn't always quick to keep up with the legalization of same-sex marriage. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If this is your story, the story of you planning a same-sex wedding here in Wisconsin or elsewhere, and maybe the wedding industry, whatever parts of it you dealt with, did serve your needs or didn't. Either way, I'd love to hear about it. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Amber, I wanted to pick up on something you mentioned, the power of the tradition of weddings, of our social script, of what we expect in this milestone, and the power it has on us if we're getting married and on the wedding business, I guess.
Sure. So in our research, we spent a lot of time before we actually started talking to couples, looking at the history of weddings and reading through historical analyses of marriage and wedding markets, because we were really interested in the kind of where the script comes from and how we learn as consumers and as, you know, individuals getting married about what that script looks like. And so in our research, we did a lot of looking at, you know, popular press and media, the way that we're socialized into what to expect for a wedding through books and movies. I know when I was a kid, I watched Father of the Bride about a million times. And so this provides an image of what kind of a traditional wedding looks like. And then once we get engaged, the wedding industry kind of, there's this machine behind it that opens up that comes out with all of the wedding checklists and things you should do and what should a bride be and what should a groom be doing and those sorts of things. So for us, it was really interesting to think about the participants in the study and the expectations they had for weddings based on their own backgrounds, their own upbringings, their immersion in the cultural phenomena of weddings through media and books and those sorts of things, as well as exposure through their own family backgrounds and weddings they had attended growing up. And then the way that that informed their own understanding of the planning of the wedding. And the example that I gave of Jocelyn just a few minutes ago, trying on the wedding dress, one thing that she said after she was reflecting on it during our interview with her, and she said, you know, as a feminist, I'm not proud of that moment where I put the dress on and it just felt right. And then I bought the dress. And to me, I found that really fascinating because that really shows this idea of the way that the emotional experience that has tied us to our prior socialization and background and the wedding script really comes into play whether you depart from the script. It feels really uncomfortable to do things that are different and that you're not sure are going to be accepted or recognized even by the audience, your family members and friends, but also to align with the script sometimes feels uncomfortable or discomforting because it's not an authentic representation of your own gender expression or your gender roles or the way that you anticipated the wedding. So I think prior socialization and that idea of the cultural phenomenon of the wedding was quite powerful throughout our analysis and our findings.
I wonder what you heard more from people, whether it was, I want to do it my way, but I'm worried that I'm doing it wrong given my own expectations, or I want to do this wedding my way, our way as a couple, but I worry that I'm letting down everybody else in the room, the family members and such who might be expecting that usual wedding script.
Both. I don't know that I heard one more than the other. I heard constant tension throughout the data and from participants in their stories, constant tension between wanting to do the wedding their way, and especially in related to honoring themselves as a couple and kind of debunking the gender roles that are embedded in the script, but also really wanting the wedding to be recognizable so that it was considered an, in quotes, a real wedding or a legitimate wedding so that the audience could recognize all the parts of the wedding that make it a tradition and part of the heritage of wedding ceremonies. So I think that tension between both authenticity as well as tradition was kind of permeated throughout their experiences.
Talking to Amber Epp from the Wisconsin School of Business, looking at research on same-sex marriage and how couples in same-sex marriages going through the wedding experience run into an industry that wasn't necessarily built for them. Amber, we hear cases going to the Supreme Court where some element of the wedding industry, a service provider of some sort, says, yeah, I'm not going to provide services to same-sex couples, becomes a court case. That isn't necessarily what always happens, though. There are examples in your research of business providers collaborating with same-sex couples to solve these problems or saying, yeah, I guess we need to change the way we do things. What kind of things did you hear?
Exactly. I mean, we did so intentionally because the study was, we were collecting data as the legalization pieces were unfolding across different states. We intentionally interviewed couples from all over the United States in both urban and rural areas, in places where it was legal and places where it was not. And then legalization came through at the federal level in 2015, right as we were kind of closing out the study. And so we got to kind of see that viewpoint of places where it was more accepted and where service providers were quite collaborative and interested in opening up this space, as well as kind of the pushback that you're talking about. What I find really interesting is that at this time right now, as we're seeing, you know, new topics on this idea of gender inclusivity and the way that the different wedding industry partners are coming to the table, I think it's even more relevant now. This study is even more relevant now than it was when legalization was first happening, because we're seeing this broader conversation in society around gender and being brought kind of into the center of the culture wars. And so for me, trying to understand the way that this study might help us think about people's experiences with that in the wedding industry, in other places, I think is really a useful way to think about takeaways.
What kind of questions would you have if you were to kick off this study today? You know, years after same-sex marriage has been legalized, what would you want to track to see how things have changed?
I would really be interested in whether and how the script has been updated kind of within the industry. I think it would be useful to do a follow-up study that looked at the way that the wedding industry has or has not kind of questioned its own assumptions. I thought the caller, Nick, who said he just got married 4 years ago in Wisconsin and that the courthouse forms were still bride and groom, is telling, right? It suggests that there's more work in terms of just really understanding inclusivity. So there's, you know, no reason necessarily that the forms need to be gendered, especially given the legal status of marriage between same-sex couples. And so I think doing follow-ups where we're looking at the way that the industry has or has not revisited those assumptions about a binary built into the script, both kind of formally in the infrastructure and the forms and those sorts of things, but also informally in terms of, you know, who's targeted for checklists for wedding planning and who's included in the imagery and those sorts of things, I think would be useful to think about.
Amber, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, thanks so much for having me on. I had a great time.
That's Amber Epp, Associate Professor of Marketing in the Wisconsin School of Business. We talked to her today about a study she wrote for the Journal of Consumer Research looking at how same-sex couples are dealing with the wedding industry built around brides and grooms. Still time for you to share your story, or if you know someone who's encountered some of the pitfalls we've been talking about today, let us know about it. Love to hear, especially if you got something in the last year or two. Email ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. The comedian Roy Wood Jr. hosted this year's White House Correspondents' Dinner. He delivered a speech that was half comedy roast and half social commentary. Speaking to a room full of reporters and editors from some of the biggest publications across the country, he pointed out one of the biggest problems he sees in the media industry today.
All the essential, fair, and nuanced reporting, it's all stuck behind a paywall. People can't afford rent, people can't afford food, not healthy food, they can't afford an education, they damn sure can't afford to pay for the truth. Say what you want about a conspiracy theory, but at least it's affordable. I mean, well, unless you Alex Jones, it'll cost you about $900 million. And I understand that we have to put the stuff behind the paywall because creating the truth is important. People can't afford the truth, but you all can't afford to go find the truth for free.
Wood's speech highlighted a challenge journalists face when it comes to funding their work. Quality reporting can be expensive, it takes a lot of time, and online ad revenue alone generally isn't enough to pay for it. Paywall subscriptions can generate the kind of revenue needed to pay for in-depth journalism. That can create, though, an information gap between those who can afford to pay for quality reporting and those who can't. It's a problem that outlets around the country are struggling to work through. Some are experimenting with new and creative ways to fund their work while keeping their reporting as accessible as possible. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you get frustrated when you run into online paywalls for that article, that one article that you want to read? Do you subscribe to some publications, local, regional, national, that have these kind of paywalls? Do you feel like you miss out on quality journalism because you can't afford to subscribe to these services? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. This summer, she'll take over as the new director of the UW-Madison School of Journalism and Mass Communication. Katie, welcome back to Central Time.
I'm so happy to be here.
How big a problem do you see this being, that there may be an information gap between people who can afford to subscribe to news services and those who can't?
I think that there's always been a problem with that, with having balanced and reliable information. People subscribed to the newspaper in the 1950s and 60s, and people who could afford it did, and people who couldn't afford it didn't. So the gap isn't necessarily something that's new. What's new is the malignancy of conspiracy theories, misinformation, disinformation that is free. So this is now available to us online when it wasn't in the 1950s or 60s when my parents were subscribing to the Milwaukee Journal.
Are there things about the economics of the news media now that makes it more of a reach for people, especially to get local reporting that's valuable to them, given the economics of the situation?
Yeah, the economics for local news are not pretty. And it relates in part to a loss of subscribers, but also, importantly, a loss of advertisers. So if you look about 10 to 12 years ago, we were at about 12% of the national ad spend. So everyone from your local car dealer to Dove soap was going toward local news. Now that number is about 2%. So you see advertising going to other places, including targeted social media advertising.
Now, the information gap we started with was between those who could afford a subscription and those who couldn't. How about between places that are maybe bigger cities that are packed with media outlets and smaller towns, rural communities? Is that so-called news deserts? Is that an information gap you worry about?
It's absolutely an information gap that I worry about. News deserts are very, very serious in places like Wisconsin and, in fact, all over the country. But one of the things that some research is showing is that those news deserts have increasing polarization, because they don't have the local news outlet. They're sort of nationalized in their politics. So rather than thinking about who's the neighbor I want to run for the local school board, they're more heavily fixated on, say, a Senate race in Georgia, because their news sources are more nationalized.
Let's look at different possible funding models for, you know, the online age of news. Now, for a while, there was the idea that we're going to do it all with web advertising, online advertising, which means we're going to have so many stories that go so viral and we'll get so many clicks. And how's that worked out?
It hasn't worked out. We have not solved the advertising conundrum for news in any way. And so we do have to look at other funding models. Part of that's going to be philanthropy. Part of it is going to be looking at things like nonprofit approaches, and then also public media, like we're on right now.
Mm-hmm. Now, how about paywalls? It seems like some news outlets, some of the big national newspapers, have enough of a subscriber base, enough of a reach that is a viable model.
It is, especially depending on your audience. The Wall Street Journal probably has the most viable paywall, given that a lot of businesses pay for its subscriptions for their employees. I think you are seeing some real thoughtfulness and some ethics and integrity coming into paywall discussions now, particularly when we went through COVID and people needing all of that information. Most outlets put that information outside of in front of their paywall so that you didn't have to pay to get it. And so now I hear from some editors and publishers who are saying, you know, hey, maybe it makes sense to have the latest Green Bay Packers Aaron Rodgers trade behind the paywall, but I'm going to put this election information out in front of it, because sadly, some people are more likely to pay for Packer info than they are to figure out who to vote for.
I know this isn't a brand new concern with the internet, but is there a worry that, okay, if I know a certain group of people can afford to pay for my web service, for my newspaper, I'm going to craft my news to appeal to that kind of customer?
Sure, to appeal to that kind of customer, and then also to appeal to what's the most clickable. Are we getting more sensationalism? Are we getting less substantive coverage? Those are all really important worries.
Do you think we are getting more of that? Because I know I've talked on the show about, you know, the 1800s, a newspaper publisher who had a great series on the discoveries of life on Mars with surprising detail. Like, sensationalism isn't new. Do you think it is in some ways worse now?
Sensationalism is not new, but it has more reach than it used to have. In some ways, less reach, because we do have fewer super powerhouse, everybody, you know, watches Walter Cronkite kind of figures. There's more atomization, so there's more choice. But those things that are bogus are getting better reach now.
Talking to Kathleen Culver from the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison, looking at access to news, affordability of news services in the modern media age. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you subscribe to a physical newspaper? Do you pay to see the stories behind paywalls on your local newspaper, a big city newspaper, one of the national outlets? Does it keep you away, a paywall, from seeing stories you want to see? Call in and let us know at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Allison in Madison couldn't stay on the line, but wants to know about the importance of libraries in accessing news and whether that's changed with online paywalls. Now, a lot of libraries do have subscriptions to periodicals and daily papers.
I love Allison's question because I could not possibly be a bigger fan of the public library. You know, when we talk about news deserts, one of the things that we think about is what other civic institutions are important in bringing us together, in getting us to talk about the local soccer team, to pay attention to the new business opening. And I think that libraries are one of those critical civic institutions. And they are places that we can access information, reliable information, for free.
Thanks a lot for that question, Allison. You also mentioned, Katie, outlets saying, okay, maybe that Packers news, you got to pay for that, but the election news, we'll let you have at least some of that for free. I know during COVID, some paywall outlets put the daily COVID tracker information in front of the paywall, not behind it, so people get it. What other kind of distinctions could we make between, okay, this is our public service and you can have it for free versus this is stuff you got to pay for?
You know, it's such an important and vital question. And I bump into it sometimes with people who contact me because someone has tried to share something with them and they used to be able to access it if it was shared via social media. But a lot of outlets have now changed that practice as well. So I think vital civic information, there's an argument for that to be in front of the paywall. But then also each of us as citizens asking, what investment are we making in news? And that you may not enjoy your local news outlet, and it may be too expensive, and you don't want to place your investment there. Are you maybe making a donation to public media? Are you looking at other ways to support news? Because it's not just on the news media to fix this problem. All of us who need that information have to be invested too.
We're talking to UW-Madison journalism professor Katie Culver about online paywalls and the costs of quality journalism. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you feel like you're in a news desert in some ways where, especially maybe for local news, local government news, you don't get a lot of reporting on it, maybe not as much as you used to? And at whatever level, do you subscribe to a newspaper, whether in print or online? Let us know at 800-642-1234. Your experiences, your questions, 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Katie Culver, professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. We're talking about journalism behind paywalls and the conflict between access to quality reporting and how to pay for it. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What kind of reporting are you willing to pay for? Is there something that you subscribe to? Love to hear what it is. Would you be willing to pay more for a particular kind of journalism, a particular coverage maybe in your local area? What questions do you have about how journalism is funded or not funded in some cases? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email at ideas@wpr.org. Katie, you mentioned briefly earlier there are nonprofit models, not just public media, public radio, and public TV. What kind of things do you see out there that look promising?
I think the Salt Lake Tribune is one of the more promising nonprofits. Startups, it's a long-standing legacy paper, but they went to that model a few years ago, and they are making it work. Right here in Wisconsin, there's the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Journalism that does, it's on, at wisconsinwatch.org. They do phenomenal work. There are a number of those peppered across the country, but they're not easy. This is not easy to make these go.
Yeah, have we seen some come and go? Are there failed models of nonprofit attempts at journalism?
Sure, plenty of them, plenty of them. And I think we have the opportunity to learn from those, but we also need to be sure that there's an audience to support that nonprofit approach. There are some that are tremendously successful, in fact, winning Pulitzer Prizes and the like. I'm hopeful in part, but we need to invest in it.
Something I wonder about, something I worry about is, you know, every community has county board meetings and city council meetings and school board meetings. And they can be a little dry to sit through in person. I've been there. But that kind of coverage can be really important. And it might be the most important for some people. It's what's happening in their backyard. Do you see models that work in communities that may not have a huge, you know, population to begin with?
I do think there's the possibility for citizens to get involved. We're seeing more of that activity going and looking at school boards, for instance. But you're right. When there is not systematic local coverage, there are all sorts of shenanigans and malfeasance that could go on. There's the tiny community of Bell, California, lost its regional newspaper reporter, and within a short span of time, some very powerful people there had bilked their citizens out of millions of dollars because there was no journalist watching.
Let's go back to our callers now. Barry is with us in Green Bay. Barry, hello.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up, Barry?
Yes, I'm interested in your conversation. I equate having a subscription to your local newspaper with patriotism. I mean, I know that the media has been called the fourth estate. I can't imagine that any of the other three, portions of the government would in any way be functional without having a critical media. We've seen evidence of the fact that now the judiciary has rejected the scrutiny of the other two branches of the government, and what other alternative is there but to have the media shaming them continuously? And it's going to take years probably to get that judicial institution to begin to actually shine the light on its own.
Gotcha, Barry. Thanks a lot for the call. There's a Thomas Jefferson quote, I think, that I'm
going to
butcher here, but I'd rather have a press without a government than government without a press, something
yep.
like that.
Yeah.
That reminds Barry's thoughts. What do you think?
Yeah, I think Barry is spot on, and thank you for recognizing the role of journalism. Now, that's not to say that journalists always get it right, mm-hmm. that they always serve as the best check on other powerful institutions. Sometimes they're very much in line with other powerful institutions. Mm-hmm. But I think we have example upon example upon example here in Wisconsin and across the country where we are served as citizens by the work of journalists who do their job with integrity.
Thanks a lot for that call. Chris joins us now in Fairchild. Chris, hi.
Yes. So first off, I just wanted to say thank you to NPR for putting a spot on this, as always. Terrific. And second of all, I don't know if my wife and I are kind of the exception to the rule, but we are constantly, regardless of paywall, trying to seek out the most fair and honest reporting to make the best judgment of government or what's going on locally. So unfortunate as it is, and as much as I disagree that it shouldn't be, journalism has to be funded in some form. So if we have to, we're happy to pay for it if need be.
And Chris, may I ask, do you and your wife subscribe to any particular outlets?
Oh, well, we run the gamut. We go around the country. We look for, I'd like to go to look at what's going on in L.A., San Diego, New York, Chicago, to try and get a feel of what's going on around the country. And it helps give a balance to what a reporter might be bringing forward.
Chris, thanks for the call. Katie.
You know, I think, Chris, thanks again, Chris, for being a great news consumer. I think you raised an interesting point that makes me remember I should have pointed to two other things. So really in the area of antitrust, that's something where news organizations are held up by law from cooperating and setting subscription prices and that sort of thing and subscription agreements. So, you know, as Chris tries to look at Arizona, L.A., wouldn't it be great if he had one central, you know, news subscriber account where he could go to all of these other outlets. You know, everybody is like, oh, I pay for this Gannett paper, the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, but I go to the Gannett paper in Tennessee to try to find out what's going on there, and I can't log in. So I think that's an important element. And then also related to antitrust, news outlets have not been able to band together to deal with big tech when it comes to setting ad rates. And that's a real problem. There was an effort to push that forward, a bipartisan effort in Congress last year. It went down in flames, unfortunately. But that's something that we're going to need to look at, too.
Chris, thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Katie, for years I was hearing like, okay, we're right on the verge of microtransactions for media. So you know, I'm online a lot for my job. And hey, there's this cool article in the Miami Herald or Philadelphia Inquirer. The model was supposed to be I could put $50 into an account and I'd open this article for $1. That seems to have disappeared. I haven't heard anything about that lately.
Well, a lot of us were hopeful that if Elon Musk were living on planet Earth instead of on Mars, that's what he would have done with Twitter. He would have turned it into a micropayments platform that actually could have helped support publishers for the work that they do put out. I haven't lost all hope, but again, we're not going to see any forward motion on that when we have antitrust restrictions on publishers.
Thanks again for that call at 800-642-1234. Talking to Katie Culver from the UW-Madison Center for Journalism Ethics, looking at how we pay for our news, whether we pay for our news. Still time for your call at 800-642-1234. Dan joins us now in Eau Claire. Dan, hi.
Hi. Say, there's a site on the internet called archive.is. It's pretty easy to get to. It's about a week behind, but almost every article printed in this country and around the world is posted on that. It's a free service, and like I said, it's about a week behind, but it's, you know, if you can't afford it, you can afford this.
Dan, thanks a lot for the call. I've seen links to this. I'm not sure how it works legally and or ethically, Katie.
Yeah, there's some real intellectual property questions around this. But some news outlets are trying, testing being part of free services to bring people in and then drive them to other content and bring in more eyes on their ads. So just be careful. Anything that's offered for free, always ask what's the quality of that and do they really own it?
Speaking of, thanks again for that call. Speaking of, you mentioned the links between social media and journalism. Obviously, a lot of people on social media share links to journalism. A lot of questions about how the money flows, who ends up profiting from this. The infamous pivot to video from a few years back where Facebook basically single-handedly persuaded newspapers to start doing more videos that I think hardly anybody watched. Your thoughts on social media and how it's affected journalism?
Well, it's affected journalism in a lot of ways, but one of the ways that I like to point to the most is that it's important to think about ethics right now, not just in terms of journalism, but in terms of all public communication. So, you know, journalism is my life, and I will love it forever. But it's one piece of our information ecology. And if the other pieces of that ecology are toxic, then we have problems. You know, I noticed in the news break leading in that we saw that we were hearing a news story about an amazing rise in youth voters. That is not driven by local newspapers. Mm-hmm. That is driven by TikTok. And so if we have a prayer for the future, it's got to be that all public communicators feel a sense of responsibility to truth and to minimizing harm and the like.
Yeah, that's it. It's a constant dilemma, even for us at public radio. How much do we do on a social media platform? How reliable is that platform as ownership changes, whether that's Elon Musk or a Chinese company owning TikTok? How are you seeing journalism outlets try to navigate that?
I think a lot of journalism outlets recall very well the hard lesson they learned with the, quote, pivot to video and almost universally lost money on that experiment. So I think there's a little bit more of a conservative approach now, but definitely an emphasis on younger users, readers, viewers, and bringing in that audience. And given that they're more politically engaged than their predecessor generations, maybe they will turn more to news. I can only hope.
In just our last minute, what do you have your eye on now? What is on the horizon that has you excited and or worried or both?
Actually, that youth engagement does have me very optimistic. My glass is very half full with the generation that's coming through my classrooms right now. They're smart. They want to be informed. They want neutral information, and they really care. They want a world that aligns with their values, and that makes me very optimistic. Now, if I can just convince them to read up for something other than answering my news quizzes, that'd be great.
Katie, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's always great to be here.
Kathleen Bartson-Culver is an associate professor and director of the Center for Journalism Ethics at UW-Madison. She was with us today to talk about the role of online paywalls in news coverage and how we can make high-quality reporting financially viable for news outlets and their audiences. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, your name could say a lot about you. It might carry your reputation, your identity as an individual. You might be named after someone and feel that deeper connection to them. Your last name might say something about your family, maybe where your ancestors came from. Or you might change your name legally or informally in daily use to better reflect who you see yourself as, the perception you want to give off. Historically, name changes were often a way to avoid discrimination, but over time, people's motivations for changing their names have also shifted. Our next guest has spent more than a decade researching name changes and ethnic identity to understand what our names say about us and why we might change them. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you changed your name for one reason or another, first and or last, legally or just, you know, what people call you in person? Why did you want to change it? And do you know the story of your family's last name? Was it changed maybe in the early days of immigration? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Kirsten Vermeiglich is a professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, where she researches the historical meanings and nature of ethnic identity. She's the author of several books. Her most recent is called A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. Kirsten, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate your inviting me to be on this.
Now, you did some fascinating research for that book I mentioned. You look back now in New York, where so many immigrants started their experience in the United States, going back, looking over name-changing petitions in the U.S. for decades and decades. What inspired you to dig into those?
Oh, well, I usually say to people as a joke that when you have a name like Kirsten Vermeiglich, of course you're going to be interested in name changing.
The ferrets of the world, by the way, but I stuck with it.
And we actually have family members who've changed their names even more, and there's a whole firm part of my family. I never changed my name. The name did used to be something long, slightly different, but it wasn't really. I mean, that played a role in it. I think I've always found names fascinating, but I'm also a scholar of American Jewish history and American history. And I have always been really interested in sort of the ways that people kind of use names to try to identify, particularly who's Jewish, you know, sort of ideas about sort of what a Jewish name is. And so I just thought it would be a really interesting place to go to kind of think about how people have defined their ethnic community and thought about who is and who's not in the community.
I have this notion in my head that there are so many people who came from Eastern Europe or Italy or you name it, and they hit Ellis Island, and that Ellis Island clerk simplified or Americanized their names. And according to your research, I guess, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, you know, so my research You know, I usually sort of say that genealogists and anybody who's really looked at Ellis Island kind of knows that this isn't the case, that it certainly was not a wide scale phenomenon. There's no evidence of it. If you look sometimes, I mean, it's hard to do this on the radio. I sometimes will do this visually. If you look at manifests, which people listening to the show might have done genealogy and they might have looked at the ship manifests where their ancestors came in. And if you look closely at those, you'll see little check marks. People at Ellis Island, the officials at Ellis Island actually didn't take record. They didn't actually write down anybody's name. They actually checked your name against your ship manifest. And there were actually rules at Ellis Island saying you could not change a name. And in fact, American law, all the states in the United States are actually very flexible in their naming, in the ability to change your name. So even if an Ellis Island official did change your name, you could just change it back really easily and quickly and unofficially. So usually, I and other scholars kind of want to emphasize that probably your name was not changed at Ellis Island, even though I know that's really disappointing and upsetting for people who've heard that story from families. And instead, what I found in my research is actually, if you look at name change petitions, so many people actually chose to change their names.
Let's talk about that. And in your research, you found that recent Jewish immigrants, or maybe even not so recent, changed their names, not just because they wanted to sound more American, but for very specific reasons. Discrimination. What did you find?
Yeah, I mean, I was really, when I went into my research, I really didn't know what to find. Really, nobody else has done this research before me. There's very little research into name changing. So I really didn't know what to expect. And I was really, really surprised to see, I mean, my first experience in walking into the archive the first day, I walked actually into the courthouse and they just showed me into this little tiny room that just had wall-to-wall boxes of name change petitions and like huge numbers of them were all 1930s and 1940s, especially just boxes and boxes. So not during an era of major immigration. And instead sort of the largest numbers came in the 1920s, 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, after immigration had actually slowed to a trickle. And so what was really interesting to see, so that was one thing that really surprised me. And the other thing that I hadn't really expected was how many Jewish surnames were being changed. Predominantly surnames, some first names too, but predominantly surnames. And it really matches up with the institution and sort of the spiraling of institutionalized anti-Semitism in the United States, which really rose in the 1920s, 1930s, and 1940s. And so I think it's really significant that all these Jews are changing their names at this time when they pay a penalty for having Jewish surnames or Jewish names at all. People sort of identify them and then won't give them jobs, won't let them into schools. And so I think that that was really significant that at that time, as people are experiencing this kind of discrimination, they're choosing to erase these names that kind of made them targets.
Talking to historian Kirsten Vermeiglisch from Michigan State University, looking at the history of name changes in the United States, why we change our names and how that changes over history. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a story maybe about the evolution of a name in your family, an official name change, or how the pronunciation maybe changed over the years? Have you changed your name for some reason? What led to that? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, I imagine this must be an ambivalent moment for a lot of people historically. They would like to not be discriminated against. They'd like to get that job. So there's that incentive to change a name. But they might feel like, hey, what about this connection with, you know, my family and all of its history?
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, you know, what I wound up finding was a lot of both about sort of family history, but also about how people felt in the moment, their communities, right? So what I think a lot of people hadn't really looked at before, and what I think that I was able to find in my research was that certainly in the Jewish community, there was a lot of ambivalence and actually kind of anger and frustration with Jewish name changers, especially after World War II. After the Holocaust, there was a great deal of kind of frustration and anger even directed at people who had changed their names. So people who changed their names reported being made fun of by members of their community. I found a petition of a man who had changed his name, and when he wanted to get married, the family he was marrying into made him change his name back. They refused to allow their daughter to get married to the changed name. So there was a lot of, and there were a lot of movies and books and other kinds of cultural artifacts that, you know, sort of made fun of name changers or kind of made them the villains in the stories. I think there was a lot of and a lot of kind of family disquiet. You know, I interviewed a few people who talked about sort of anger and frustration, or just unhappiness that they had this name that had been changed and they hadn't known about it, you know, family secrets and things like that. So yeah, I think that it led to, I think, some disruption and really sort of pointed to some fissures within the Jewish community as people had different responses to anti-Semitism. They had different responses to sort of how to deal with the discrimination they were facing.
In that time period, did you see other communities seeing similar waves of name changes? I think in pop culture of the Untouchables movie where a Giuseppe Petri becomes George Stone, was this happening with non-Jewish groups in New York?
Yeah, it's a really good question. And as I say, when I started doing the project, I actually thought I was going to see people of all groups changing their names. Maybe I didn't say that, but I should have. I didn't know what to expect. And I didn't necessarily think that it was going to be overwhelmingly Jews. And I most certainly did see Italians and Poles. I mean, it's New York, so it was inflected by the groups that are there. So a lot of Italians and Greeks, smaller numbers of people with Polish surnames. But I absolutely did see those. You know, one reason certainly there were many more Jews than there were those groups. And I think one reason for that is probably the kinds of jobs that Jews were looking for in comparison to other ethnic groups. Jews at that time, the 1920s and the 1930s, were predominantly looking for white or pink collar jobs. So clerks, women were looking for jobs as secretaries. And for a lot of other ethnic groups, Italians and Greeks, they might not have been looking for those kinds of jobs. Women would frequently stay outside of the paid workforce. Men were frequently looking for more working class jobs, maybe longshoremen jobs, union jobs. And those were jobs that at that time, you didn't need to fill out an application form. It's kind of weird to think about at this moment, but like the filling out of an application form and the way that your name might attract attention was really significant at this time in history. So Italians who might've changed their names, Poles who might've changed their names, they might not have felt that they needed to do so kind of legally and formally using these name change petitions. If they were looking for working class jobs, they might have gone to like another union member, right? And been like, you know, can you find me a job at the factory? Or they might have found a job by standing on a street corner, right? And, you know, sort of getting a job. Domestic servants might have found a job that way. So Jews, both because they're experiencing more discrimination and also because they're looking for white collar work where they have to put their names down on a form in a way that other groups aren't. So I absolutely see, and this is not to say that I think other groups were absolutely changing their names, but maybe not in so many numbers, because they're not facing the same kinds of, you know, this rise of anti-Semitism, but also because they're looking for different kinds of jobs. And so they show up in the economy in different ways, and their names aren't necessarily attracting the same kinds of negative attention that Jews are at that time.
Let's bring on a caller. Kristen is with us in Middleton. Kristen, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I'm trying to mess with the phone here. I grew up outside of Detroit, and my father had always told me, oh, we go way back in the history of Detroit, back to the 1700s, but our name was not always Hall. It was some French name. And as I got into genealogy, it's my brick wall. I didn't know where to go with that. And with the help of some angels and some help, I finally found out what our French name was. And in Canada, the name was Michel Batry, but when they would cross the border, across the river into Detroit, because of the discrimination, they would use their stepfather's name back in 1803, the Betry wife married a man named Benjamin Hall.
Uh-huh.
So when they crossed to Detroit, they became Hall. They go back to the Windsor area, and they were Betry. So back and forth with baptismal papers over there was Betry.
Wow. Kristen, thanks a lot for sharing that, and I'm glad you solved that mystery. Kirsten, I don't know if you have a lot of Quebecois people showing up to your records in New York, but that kind of back home, we're still old name. Over here, we are new name, I guess, probably didn't just happen in Detroit.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's a super fascinating story. Thank you so much for calling in. And it really does sort of show, I think, the significance of discrimination. I think so much of name changing, people sort of generally say, oh, people wanted to Americanize. But I think really thinking about the impact of discrimination on groups and the reasons, very practical reasons that people want to change names, I think that's a super important part of that story. And I think also another important part of that story is, yeah, wanting to keep connections to family. Right? People don't necessarily always want to just be remaking themselves and erasing their older family connections. They want to maintain those connections a lot of times. And so name changes is sometimes something that people see as very practical. And yeah, I mean, definitely I found stories in New York of people who might have come and found, say, that their family members are using a different name, right? Their families have taken on a different name, and maybe they're living with that family, or their family has convinced them that this is, you know, a good name to take on in the United States, or they may themselves be experiencing discrimination, or they may feel that sort of to, you know, sort of present a level of kind of middle class respectability, right? If everybody in the family has that name, that it might be embarrassing for one last person not to have changed their name. So I think that there was some pressure there for people to take on the name that you know, other people had already taken on. So I think all of those kinds of factors play a role. I'm really so glad that you were able to find that too. I certainly talked to a lot of people who do genealogy and they can't figure out right where it came from. So that's wonderful that you were able to find that.
Thanks a lot for that call, Kristen. We're talking to Michigan State University History and Jewish Studies Professor Kirsten Vermeiglisch about why we change our names, how our names shape our identities, historical trends in why and when people change their names. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Did your name change in your family's history, your last name? Have you changed your name? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Kirsten Vermeiglisch. She researches ethnic identity as a professor of history at Michigan State University. She's with us today talking about the role our names play in our identities and why people change their names and why those reasons have changed over time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Kirsten, the reason people have changed their names has changed over time. You followed other ethnic groups at different points in history. What kind of things have stood out to you?
Well, so, you know, much of the work, I mean, certainly and guided by what I saw in the archive, there was definitely this sort of phenomenon of Jews changing their names, say from like 1917 through the 1960s. And then Jews kind of fell out of the petitions, I think, as institutionalized anti-Semitism dropped out of the workforce. I think fewer people felt that they needed to change their names. But by the 21st century, the name changes remained pretty low. But then by 2001, and the years after 9/11, I saw a huge upsurge in name changing. The population of New York City changed. Far more people of color, people of Asian background, Latino, Black, Middle Eastern, North African peoples all moved into the city. And so by the years after 2001, by the 21st century, I really saw sort of an intense flourishing of name changing from all those different groups. you know, some of the ones that seemed sort of interesting to me were ones, I mean, there was no one group that kind of dominated, but there were a good number of Asian Americans changing their names in ways that were in some ways similar and some ways different from what happened earlier in the 20th century. And then also the case of Muslim Americans was also in some ways similar to what happened to Jews earlier, and then in some ways really, really different and really fascinating that sort of talks differently about what discrimination looks like today for different ethnic groups and people of color.
Did that post 9/11 wave continue for a long time, or was it a brief flare up of people with, Muslim sounding names changed their name just last for a couple of years?
Yeah, no, I initially stopped my research in the, you know, I thought I would just stop with the 20th century. And then people said to me, you should really go look and see what happened after 9/11 to people with Muslim sounding and North African sounding names. And so I did, and I was really struck to see that in the years right after 9/11, that, you know, there was an upsurge in name changing among people who had names that sounded Muslim, people with names like Muhammad, people who had names like Osama, people with those kinds of names were changing their names in similar numbers, with a lot of the reasoning that sounded sometimes more explicit than what Jews had said earlier in the century. And sometimes that sounded exactly like what had happened earlier in this century. People worrying about not getting jobs, people worrying about not being able to get into school, people worried about sort of suspicion or anger or being embarrassed in front of, other people. I mean, really, sometimes really heartbreaking kinds of petitions. What I found striking was that the petitions did not stay as much of an upsurge. So by 2012, 11 years after 2001, I didn't see disproportionate numbers of people with Middle Eastern or North African names changing their names.
I want to bring on one more quick call before we're out of time. Sharon is with us in La Crosse. Sharon, hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up a couple points about first names being very feminine or very masculine, and that people that are transgender, changing their names, and sometimes that name change can be public. It can be a public notice, or you can have a judge that'll help you change it privately.
I gotcha, Sharon. We just have a few moments left, Kirsten, but that seems like it'd be an interesting field for future research, people who are changing gender identity and legally changing their names.
Actually, I'm just going to be publishing an article about that, actually. I think that's a fantastic point, and I'm so glad you brought it up. In addition to sort of seeing more Muslim names or more Asian American names, I actually found large numbers of people who are transgender changing their names. And New York City, actually, in terms of talking about doing it privately instead of publicly, New York City began to waive. Used to have to do it publicly, but New York City began waiving it because so many people who are transgender were afraid for their safety. And so now you can do that more privately. That is a really important contemporary trend in name changing. I'm so glad you brought that up.
Thanks for that call, Sharon. And Kirsten, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoyed this. Have a wonderful day.
You too. That's Kirsten Vermeiglich, professor of history and Jewish studies at Michigan State University, author of the book A Rosenberg by Any Other Name, A History of Jewish Name Changing in America. She's with us today to talk about name changing, how trends in why people change their names have changed over time. I'm Rob Barrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.